So the title of this talk is Unique Selves Part 2, with a little decoy at the beginning. How would you say a decoy?
Like something that you put, excuse me, hunting, like if you put a duck on, a wooden duck on the water.
And I don't mean it like that.
Like a detour.
Yeah, something I'm speaking about something else first, and then I'm coming back to the flow of unique selves.
Detour.
Detour. Yes. Yes. So, some of you would have been there in the 10-day retreat where I mentioned in one talk how quite astonishing it is that we're gathered here together and are living like monastics for 10 days, for some then, or for some of us, over 5 weeks, between 5 and 6 weeks, we're wholeheartedly engaging in this deepening process. And for most of us, I imagine, to a certain extent in this time, we're practicing celibacy. And for some people, this can be something that is quite unusual, that is unique to the rest of the flow of life. And it can be noticeable during the retreat that we are abstaining from something, and certain energies can start to flow through us. So I say most of us, because we can never be sure what rendezvous are happening on the retreat. But it's definitely sure that we're really closing down certain avenues of ways that we usually know ourselves and ways that we relate that give us a sense of ourselves. So there's not the same amount, perhaps, of flirtation going on in this kind of environment, except maybe across from when we're serving food and eyes are meeting. But things are really minimized. And this does something to the inner life and does something to the being. So I just felt to speak to this a little. In a monastery, and we are practicing as if we were in a monastery with that kind of commitment, monks and nuns would take very clear vows about abstinence, about not engaging with sexuality. And here we are in a unique environment in that we're coming into this with a little more freedom, a little more room. The rules are not so hard and fast upon us. So in the monastery, these vows of celibacy would come with the intention to protect the inner life from what is thought to be hindering the deepening of spiritual practice. A sense that for this time, this life, they take the vow to not engage in pleasures that one could say are passing, to find something inside that doesn't need another to be dependent upon, to reach a depth of inner pleasure, of inner resourcefulness that's not dependent on another. That there was this intention to stop certain behavior in a way that gives a clear boundary that we can really find the jewel inside, that we might habitually try to find outside of ourselves. And in a monastery, monks would be given different practices to work with desire. And it's interesting because the practices that you read are often for monks, that women's desire in that situation wasn't so tracked. Remembering, I said on the 10-day retreat about, I was once walking through a hospital, visiting my niece that was just born, and I saw a basin with a boy, and on the boy it said, "I'm a boy." And on the girl it said, "It's a girl." And as if the boy already had his own internal voice, but the girl didn't have an internal voice, but only eyes viewing her to give her a sense of what she was. But so if we were, just say we were all men and we were all monks in a monastery, and desire was starting to come up in the being, what would be suggested possibly was deconstructing the person you were desiring. To pull out in your imagination one hair by one hair and look at the hair and say, is this attractive? Or perhaps we would pull out teeth by one tooth by one tooth. Do you want this tooth? Or perhaps we would start to think, we would peel the skin off a scalp and peel the skin off and start to see the being underneath, the blood, the tissue. And we would ask ourselves, is this attractive? Is this worth desiring? I clearly remember sitting in the Tibetan monastery on a one-month retreat and it being said, this body is a hindrance. And I remember quietly sitting there with my hands on my thighs, but what a beautiful hindrance. Often in the literature you might find that women who lead you into desire, a wayward, I read the word, or debauch. Debauch is like sort of disgustingly relishing in the pleasures. So way off track. That these women are catching you in their snare. It's their fault. So we need to stay away from that temptation. So whilst I think these anecdotes to desire have some meaning in that they remind us how impermanent this body is, how changeable this body is, they also make me very sad, actually. And I remember then 20 years old thinking, I don't know about this. That somehow, whilst we're trying to move away from ill will, to move away from ill will, to deepen our capacity to love, to really love and know what love is for another, that these practices, again, were generating aversion, generating ill will towards the bodily experience and to women. And that they were also some ways reflective of the times that were lived in when these teachings were given. That they somehow you could think of them as crude safeguards that monks could practice who were not yet mature enough to love their way into insight, to love their way into deep insight rather than to deny their way into it. I recently met some nuns in Bodh Gaya. They were part of the lineage of some women who were ordained in Australia in Perth by the Theravadan tradition rooted in Thailand. And they were ordained and it caused great splits within the community where the elder monks thought it was not right for these women to take full ordination. And there was a big hoo-ha in the whole community about staying true to tradition or can we really support women to go even deeper. And I met some women who were connected to a monastery in England who were suffering very deeply through this happening. And they were speaking to me about their life in the monastery in England and saying, you know, how deeply indebted they felt to the Buddha and to the tradition that had allowed them to wholeheartedly deepen into this inner jewel and be able to love others without need, but that they were feeling incredibly restricted in that environment. And they were speaking about it with great hardship and confusion, like wanting to really respect the tradition, but always also feeling this light coming inside that was saying something about this isn't quite okay. And it was their experience that in the monastery, certain, say, patriarchal views or chauvinistic views were feeded in disguise as some traditional sense. So, like, the men, like, in ordinations, the men could come to the women's, but the women couldn't come to the men's. In certain circles, originally they'd be allowed to sit in for prayer services. Suddenly, they weren't allowed to take part in anymore. And so I don't really come to any conclusions about that. I'm just saying that it's always good to have that inner light on that keeps questioning with whatever is being presented to us, that we keep questioning from this light of, is this freedom? Is this supporting all beings to deepen their capacity to love? Is this making more respect for each other? Is this allowing for more diversity and freshness and life? Or is it not? Something that would happen in these monasteries, once the men had done all these practices, is that once they had actually reached a certain stage where they were ripe enough, where they weren't going to engage in sexual activity and trying to grab or possess that which they were being with, but they could use it to really mutually enhance each other, it was then seen as a very worthwhile practice. And often it was quite wild men that had lived out in wild women that had broken through a lot of taboos and found a level of freedom that these monks would come together with. And there's a story where one of the a main teacher in a monastery, Song Karpa, is that right? Yeah. Where he really felt he was ripe. He felt he'd reached a level where he could look at a woman and only want to open her and behold her and didn't want her to feel his own vision or need. He felt he was ready to come into this way of relating. But he decided not to. And he speaks about some sadness about this. He decided not to because he thought the monks under him wouldn't be ready enough to understand it. So he didn't, and he thought, in my next life, I will engage like this. So how it describes this meeting is that the desire becomes fueled by compassion. Compassion fuels the desire for the opening. So it's interesting to see where our desire makes us want to cling, or where our desire opens us to love even more. And so as we start to unwind these energies, unwind this sense of moving from a sense of lack, that which I desire is going to fulfill me, but more moving for a sense of openness, that what my desire, the strength of this feeling, could open in the world or could open in another, is an interesting point. It was also spoken about this sort of meeting, say, between Long Song Karpa and a consort, a woman, a very awake woman, was evoking the deep heart in each other, a kind of desire that wants to evoke the deep heart. that moves through the tendencies and can see the deep heart and wants to meet in that open place. So here we are together, men and women, practicing for 40 days or so. And we've come in a time where there's been a lot of Western movement behind us. We've had psychology, we've had feminism, and we're not monastics, we're lay people. We're really practicing in quite a fresh, new way. And it's my wish we can work with desire that arises in us with a level of maturity for all of us. That we can work in a skillful way with it that might not be just simply squashing it or cutting it, but that we can get curious about its force. So just noticing the way when desire might be there, consciously or unconsciously, we could move into fantasies. We could move into objectification of the other. We could move in a way that somehow reduces the other, but rather than deepens the other before us. Sometimes our desire has such a force and such a projection with it that it stops us from really seeing the needs of the person or the heart of the person before us. We fit them into our own agenda. So again, what is a desire that is like a lifting the ante of the heart's capacity to feel another? So how can we rest with this energy? And in this time where we are on our own, relax with this energy. And somehow welcoming this energy into the heart. That this can assist with this pregnancy of self. As you know, there's something very different when there is deep love behind desire or stimulation, or when there's just stimulation. The way love can really open, bring us close, draw each other in. So, we're at the middle mark of the retreat. We've all made it. Sometimes at this point we can start counting down days to the end. Different people have reported. But it's very so unique and so precious that we're being here together and our sole intention is for the blossoming and deepening of each of us. The sole intention for each of us to rest back deeper into our own skin. So we have 2.5 or 3 weeks left. And if we can really see this time of continuing to create this home in ourself and this intimacy with ourself. Because the way finding that deep ground inside can then inform our relationships really is lovely. I was speaking yesterday that we can take so many empowerments, say Tibetan empowerments, You have like the empowerments of Chenrezig or the empowerments of Tara, and how all these empowerments have deep value. But the empowerment of this time, of deepening self-respect to our own heart, is so potent. We could do all the empowerments we wished, or we could keep moving into relationships to get a sense of self or a sense of satisfaction. But until that empowerment of that self-respect, of really listening to the authenticity of our own heart, is deepened in, it can make things so much richer. That this being is the one that we're going to live with until we die. That this intimacy here with this being that we sit with, that we labour with, that we struggle with through these days, is this being that's going to be there when we die, that is there throughout our life. So making this internal love affair, this bed that we can lie back inside and really relax, has such value for ourselves and for the relationships that we will all are in or will be in the future. If we can continue to together as a community, use this time to fuel us, to gather energy inside, that we don't need to grasp on to the other to fill it, but that we can deepen so life's energy and abundance, as Ajay spoke of, can start to flow out of us. And of course, in relationships, there will always be good times and difficult times, of course. But if we can let this plug ourselves into this deeper source, and this can inform us, and we can become gifts to each other, and enhance each other, and deepen each other, what a lovely thing. That takes a hell of a lot of self-love and self-respect for our own flavours. So this sense of these people came together, or no, they haven't yet. I don't. Who knows if Tsongkhapa got to the next life and had a nice time. We hope he did. He worked very hard, my God. But this sense of what we can evoke in ourselves, what we can evoke in each other, through the generosity of our own gaze, to ourself or to the other. I mentioned the other day a little bit about the 2 years I spent in relative solitude. And I'd been practicing in different traditions, but when I really allowed myself just to soften into my own space, practices started to rise up that fitted me, that touched me, that were real to the raw life that was happening inside of me. And one other thing I did would be, when I was feeling a little marred, a little obstructed by passing doubts, I would lie down, I would walk to the sand dunes and lie down on the sand, and I'd just say, something's coming. There's something there, and it's wide and bright, and something's coming. I did this so much, like half an hour, just hands on chest, and she's coming. And I would say, oh, if it's a you, Ben, he's coming. Mm-hmm. Something's coming, something deep and wide that we can rest into, that kind of tickles the passing movements. And so after this period of being in this solitude, I went back to this Tibetan tradition of Tsongkhapa and these people, and did a longer retreat with where Lama Zopa was present. And I'd been quite alone for quite some time by then, so I was quite hungry for some more guidance, in a way. And there was a point where many of the people were going to take a Chenrezig empowerment. And part of taking this empowerment, you had to commit to saying 20 Chenrezig mantras every day. The God of Compassion. Compassion? Yes.
What is this empowerment?
It's an empowerment. It's like the teacher will give you an initiation into a certain energy field. And then every morning you will do something to empower that energy inside of you. So it's like they're reflections of what's inside of us in an outward image. But I thought, but sometimes I know that there's going to be times where I'm just going to want to be in silence. That I know that not every morning I can, will want to do this mantra, but I'm deeply committed to compassion. And I also wanted to be part of the movement of everyone taking this vow. And so I was in a dilemma. So I went to speak to a nun. And I'd really, like, it had been a long time of this practicing. So I was coming to speak to her. I said, I've got a dilemma. I would like to take this vow, but I have a problem because sometimes I just want to sit quietly on myself. Some mornings I won't want to do this mantra, but I can do it quite a lot. And she said, no, like this empowerment is such a higher practice than anything else you could do. Like this practice is so much higher than if you were to sit on yourself, like by yourself. She sort of went on a little bit, and something in my heart really got saddened again. And there was something in the way that she was responding to me from this tradition, not sort of seeing the earnestness that was in my question. And I don't know if I'm going to be able to express this as much as I'd like to, but I walked away and she said, and also I don't think you have enough guru devotion, or else you just want to do this compassion practice. And I was like, And I walked away and I thought, I can't live with that. Like, I actually can't live with that. I don't see one practice as higher than another practice. I see the vulnerable human heart of meeting each other, of leaping out of wherever tradition we are, to feel what's actually going on. And I also began to think, so part of me wanting to take this compassion thing is to ease the fear. Is to ease the fear. This fear inside of me, like, and I thought, so I am actually just going to sit with this fear. I am actually going to think I am an independent, free human being, and I can trust I know the way, and I'm going to sit with this fear. I'm not going to leap out of it to join something. I cried so hugely, like, on this roof of the monastery, and watched everybody else walking in to take this vow, and I walked away from that tradition. In that time, loving Lama Zopa still so deeply, like I bought this bright red flower and gave it to where he was, and I walked away. I say this just to keep trusting what you really feel inside. It's so easy not to. So I walked away, and then I came to Bodh Gaya, and then I met Jayaji, and then I met Ajay, and later I met Gemma. And things started to open up in the way they needed to open up. So if we can keep listening to our unique selves as the theme goes. I'm not denying tradition or dissing tradition. I think it has so much to offer us. But if it costs us from really listening to our own heart, I would question it. When it's supporting the heart, as they do for a long, long time, lap it up, drink it in, get the support, really, wherever, whatever serves the heart to open. Okay. Sui are in a unique situation also because we're practicing very deeply here, and I have deep respect for how everybody is diving into it so wholeheartedly. It's not easy, necessarily. We're practicing like this, but we're also lay people, we're also living in the world. So usually people practicing deeply would have the protection of a monastery to keep nourishing this sensitivity and growth. So in a sense, it is an act of courage of bringing this depth and sensitivity into life. That we're not going to be fooled by consumerism and the things that do work up a lot of the engine of mainstream culture, that you need this to be okay, you need this to be okay, you need all these things to be okay. No, we're seeing through those lies, knowing there's the inner richness we can depend upon. But I think all of us are going into life when the time comes. So how, again, that we can allow this time to really dive in and deepen so we have that inner strength to pursue what we need to pursue with integrity and vigour, whatever it may be. So, so we finished with Wordsworth yesterday, who took this risk. He was going to go into the church. He thought if he goes into the church, he's got the money, he's got the security, he can look after his sick sister. But he went for the walk through the meadows, and a vow came down to him, he says. A bond unknown to me came to me, that I should be out singing a dedicated spirit. And from then on, he decided to be a poet. So he listened to that. And he offered food for a great number of people through pursuing his poetry. So he was someone who remained deeply plugged into the deep, but also kept finding his own way to deliver it. And in the same way, Krishnamurti, who for a period really inspired me, was deeply committed to the eternal, to something that's so wide that it can come down and inform our actions. He did a lot for education in India. And he also had this very deep trust that if the human heart was given space to flower, he spoke about children being left unpressured to play, that slowly their own flavours would start to be revealed, that without that pressure, their own flavours would be revealed, and it was the teacher's task to assist them to flourish. So some people also mentioned listening to the inner voice, that I just sometimes don't hear anything, like I don't know if I have one. And there can sometimes be, with this sort of language, a perception that one day a voice is going to come down. You must go there. The voice is so close to us that we miss it, because it's so us, it's so intimate, that we can sometimes miss it, thinking it's something grander. But as Leniji, you said yesterday, often we have a sense of knowing of what is good for us. Often we have some sense, and even if it's uncomfortable, somewhere there is some sense about what's good for us and where we need to move. But we squash it through maybe others' views or society's expectations, or we squash it because we just don't believe it in enough or haven't quite had the support to trust it. But just we're listening to something that's quite close to home. It often isn't such a big booming voice. It often doesn't shout. It often settles the being and has a quietness around it. And often, even though the voice can be there, the doubts can be there very strongly. There has to be this keeping on going, keeping on going, keeping on sitting on the cushion, keeping on writing the poems, keeping on playing the violin, keeping on. And slowly with that keeping on, a momentum, an energy starts to come behind you, because like life loves it when we actually follow. Like life does come into support. There's freshness, there's like a pull for life to come in to support. So someone who has inspired me is Leonard Cohen, because he's one of those people from the 60s, the 70s, who began experimenting and really challenging the norms. And he kept going, like he really kept going with his art. And he also kept going with his meditation. And I recently went to a concert of his. Did anybody else see the Leonard Cohen concert?
A video.
And so he'd been following his art, and recently he'd lost all his money by chance. And so he'd spent a very long time in a monastery, I think it was Japan. He'd lost all his money. And so he went to Japan. And something started to really flourish in his being. And in the concert, the transmission he gave to us was as strong as any High Lama. Like the love and the beauty of the language that was pouring through really was profound. The elegance in the playing, like every musician on the harp, someone on the violin, and like the way he regarded each of the people he was playing with, like so much respect. Like everyone, it was like, and here we have our violin player who moves his fingers like wind, who holds us together. And here we have this singer who, when she sings, she touches this sweet flavour in herself and brings it forth. So it was very precise and very loving. But he went through many doubts along the way. And there was a point when he thought, when he was so depressed, that he thought he should stop singing. He was almost going to give up. And then he sung this song and asking the deep life, or asking God if he should keep singing. And this depression was really profound, like he was ready to tip over the edge. And he sung a song that I think I'll play. Yeah, it's 3 minutes. So I had more poems of his, but I think I'm just going to bypass them. I was giving poems of him wrestling with doubt, so you got the sense that it's not like it's just an easy road. It's like little by little, little by little, little by little. But if you can stay with it, the richness that can be delivered to each other. What's possible? So it's Leonard Cohen, If It Be Your Will. Yes, that's the Indian one.
Yeah.
No, it worked last time. So he was asking God if he should keep singing. And I think how he sings, we sort of get the sense if he should or not. And so he kept singing. So we can keep singing in our own way. So I wanted to ask a question. Jaya and Ajay and myself have been talking about these qualities, or inner flavour, or a sense that can start to rise when we feel close to home, or the way we each have our own flavours that can be there when we feel like we're a little closer to home through the day. And I was just curious if anyone would share with our community what it is when you feel like you're landing a little in something that feels good, that feels true, that feels a place that informs the life. Because the more we can get to know this flavour, the more it's like a felt guide. It's interesting, like in the singing at night, you really feel different flavours coming forth. Like you feel Ben, like the creative soul at the back, kind of riffing up. We have Keturah just gently doing her own thing. We have Maria and Chris, like our two side steady beats, like this. Everyone's, you know, uniqueness just gently comes. But does anyone feel willing to speak to this, or not really?
I'm not exactly sure what you're asking.
Okay, I'll try.
I don't understand the question.
Okay, cool. Anyway, that needs to be clear. I was just curious, just times through the day or in your sitting, where there's a certain flavour or a feeling where you feel that you're coming home. Just what's the quality that happens then? Does that make sense? So you could feel, say, Leonard Cohen, there's some, like, he's opening his suffering to a wider place. You know, he's starting to let your mercy spill on all these children here, like, let the hills rejoice. Or there's, he's touching something that's starting to flow. And I'm just curious when... Yes?
Sort of seeps in. I'm not fighting with my thoughts, but nonetheless they often feel like a hindrance, or in any samadhi or concentration practice, thoughts are sort of in the way. Sometimes they're there, and I'm with
So you said,
yeah.
You know, so you said, when you're not trying to fight your thoughts, they're still there, but there's some acceptance, and you're settling deeper with them. There's a peace. No. So that's a key, not fighting the thoughts. Does anybody else?
For me, it's at the moment it's moments in nature, very small moments. Like the other night, I was walking down the path, and there's a place where it's really brightly lit, and I often stop there and just look at the trees under this sort of orange light. And the other night, this huge, this giant flying squirrel kind of launched itself off this tree, and it sort of came over me. It was huge. I mean, it was this sort of size, this huge flap of skin as it sort of glided and then just sort of landed on this tree. And I was so blown away. I was just, I don't know, it was just extraordinary, just that moment of everything just dropping away in amazement, really. And often in nature, particularly here, where there's so much to look at.
That's nice. Thank you.
I had a similar thing. I was thinking for me it's a moment, I guess best way to describe it is moments of play, where something that I see suddenly becomes something else, or it gets bigger than it is, or it suddenly seems like it's, like I was taking a walk and all of a sudden there was this, it was really a shower of monkeys. I mean, the monkeys just, I don't know, so many of them just sort of rained down, and they weren't monkeys. So the moments where that might happen.
Thank you.
To have rice to lunch.
Oh, rice again!
To have rice at lunch?
Yeah.
Ah, that's your moment.
Just seems sometimes. Oh, it was just surprising. It's rice.
Is that you? Is that like playing with normality or playing with repetition?
It's playing with at the moment. Oh, it's rice. I'm hungry. It's rice.
No.
Just any few moments like that. And you can just pick and see as it the first time you see that, and you can all feel with your whole being just this little thing and take it as very simple.
Is
poof.
Nice.
And very lovely. You can laugh at all. Just sometimes I'm any anger with me, with myself, because I want to love and I avoid to expand with this way. But we can laugh a lot, and it's a very good way. It's just destroying all the walls. Just wow. Inside, inner bliss, very large, great expansion. That's good.
Does anybody else? Yes.
And when I hear the song, I feel like the song is there, but it's in this enormous space. So like the song is huge, or the space that the song is in is huge, and there's just the song and all this space, and it's just only this, but it's so big.
Mm.
Or I go to the lake and like I see the view, and that the view is in all this spaciousness.
Mm.
Like Chris and Victoria, I feel this a lot in nature, and it's sort of hard to stop it, like just one example from nature, there's so many. But swimming in the lake is really, to me, it's just like the epitome of meditation almost.
Mm.
Because there's like, with your ears underneath the water, there's this silence. And you can only hear like the sounds of like of your own body. There's the possibility of not breathing when you go underwater. There's this like incredible depth that you can't possibly measure underneath you, and it's holding you up, and like you're sort of scared to get in because it's so cold, and you can see the light like when you go underwater and look up at it, and like every single time that I get out of the lake, I mean, it's just incredible. I enjoy being in it, but every time I get out of the lake, like, I can just feel this amazing vibration, like light around me. And it's amazing. And I get that sometimes in meditation, too. But, like, with the lake, it's like a physical, direct, like, correlation, like an instant. And that to me, like, is just, like, it's amazing. I don't go swimming in the lake more often.
Perhaps we'll have, yes?
I have this sort of weird answer. But my experience was just the question.
Mm.
And sitting with the question, there was like this, like a calling, like the question like beckoned me.
Mm.
And so I just sat with it, and I'm like, do I have an answer, or do I have something to share? And just dropping through, it was like, no.
Yeah.
And then it's like, but that's it. Like
that,
that moment, that no, like that's it.
Yeah.
It's like, let me share that. No.
Yeah. But you did.
Yeah, but it's like.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
Good night. Okay. So we can have around 5 minutes of silence together. And may we continue to find ways into depth. And I just leave you with four lines from Leonard Cohen, one of his last poems. He says, may he or she crash into your temple, crash into your sitting cushion, and look out through your eyes and make you fall in love with everyone you despise. And thank you everyone for speaking. Thank you.